Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 8th of April, these are the main stories. At least one person has been killed and several wounded in the latest attack in Israel as tension continues to mount after police raids in Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. State media in Russia say the authorities have formally charged an American journalist with espionage. Poland says Ukraine has proposed to suspend its grain exports to Poland after widespread anger among farmers about lowering prices. Also in this podcast,
I believe the greatest heroes were the people of Northern Ireland and their political leaders. The people supported, worked for, and established a democratic, peaceful process as their preferred form of governance.
Politicians have been gathering in Belfast to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which helped end the Northern Ireland Troubles. We start in the Middle East, where at least one person has been killed and several wounded in an attack in Tel Aviv. The Israeli police say the victims were tourists. This follows another attack a few hours earlier in the occupied West Bank, where two British Israeli sisters were shot dead. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the scene of that shooting and vowed that the killers would be caught.
At this moment, our forces are operating in the field in hot pursuit of the terrorists. It's only a matter of time, and not much time, that we will hold them accountable.
My colleague Oliver Conway got more from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell.
One foreign tourist, we've been told by the Italian foreign ministry that he was an Italian national. He's been killed, seven wounded in a suspected car ramming attack very close to the beach in a grassy park area that would have been packed at this time of day with religious holidays for Jews, Muslims and Christians taking place. So many tourists have flocked to Israel. Those injured, we're told, are all being treated in hospital in Tel Aviv. They range in age from their teens to their 70s. Now, this is a really quite unusual attack in that it involves tourists in such a number, although we have seen in recent weeks other attacks by Palestinians that have been carried out in the city.
And it followed an attack earlier in the day in which two British Israeli sisters were killed.
That's correct. And this was on the road in the Jordan Valley in the north of the West Bank. It seems that a gunman opened fire on a car which had these two British Israeli sisters. They came from another settlement to the south of the West Bank. They were driving with their mother, we understand, on holiday for a Passover holiday to the Galilee in the north of Israel. Their mother has been seriously wounded. Now, there's been no immediate claim of responsibility for either attack, although there have been praise for these attacks from Palestinian militant groups in the Gaza Strip. And just to put this in perspective, of course, they're taking place, these attacks, hours after Israel carried out airstrikes both in Gaza and in the south of Lebanon in response to earlier rocket fire from the south of Lebanon, which actually blamed on Palestinian militants.
Yeah, I mean, do we know if the two attacks were linked, or is it just coming against this backdrop of an increase in tensions?
I mean, at the moment, we can only say that it's coming against this backdrop of very high tensions, both with the overlapping religious holidays, but also there has been these two nights of real violence at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque when it was stormed by Israeli police. They say that they were acting to stop masked agitators who barricaded themselves inside the mosque. Palestinians say that the Israeli police had no right to be there. We saw social media footage shared of police beating Palestinians with sticks inside the mosque, and in one case appearing to use a rifle butt to beat Palestinians. Those have caused outrage, really, across the region.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem speaking to my colleague Oliver Conway. And Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht is spokesperson for the Israeli Defence Force. He told the BBC's Julian Marshall that they were hoping to de-escalate the situation. And as long as things remained quiet, Israel wasn't planning further retaliatory strikes. He was speaking before the latest attack in Tel Aviv.
We had two very bad days where basically there was a convergence of three arenas, which kicked off in Jerusalem, to Gaza, and after that to Lebanon. We were under attack by Hamas and Iran.
I mean, you conflated the two there. You've said Hamas and Iran. What's your evidence for that?
Iran has been sending its tentacles all over the region. They've been supporting Hamas. They've been supporting also Lebanese Hezbollah. It's something that they've been inciting for years.
I mean, there's been a suggestion that if indeed Iran is involved in those attacks from Lebanon, what they were doing was striking back in retaliation for Israeli strikes against Iranian targets in Syria. Do you find that plausible?
I wouldn't draw a direct line. I would say that Iran is more sort of behind the scenes. We were very focused directly on Hamas and to basically put out the targets we were focused on south of Tyre were areas where the launches were coming from.
And are you aware of what targets you hit in southern Lebanon?
So it was mainly launching areas and things that were involved directly in the launches towards Israel.
And it was Hamas, was it, rather than Hezbollah?
It was Hamas, correct. That's why you didn't hear us talking about Hezbollah. I'm sure that Hezbollah were aware of it and Iran were behind the scenes, but it was directly Hamas.
So you sound very confident that you can now put a cap on this for the moment.
That's our hope. I mean, there's a certain language and a certain threshold, which is for people that are, you know, an old soldier like myself, you understand it. Also where the rockets fail, how far we went out. We are looking for this event. If it stays quiet, we're hoping it to stay quiet. Again, we're ready. Temple Mount this morning was quiet. Sadly, we had a treacherous attack in our Jordan Valley where two ladies were shot at from a family in a stakeout. Again, Judea and Samaria right now is also very volatile.
Trying to calm things down at this particular point, but I just wondered whether on reflection you felt that Israeli riot police had used heavy-handed tactics when they stormed the prayer hall of Al-Aqsa Mosque in a pre-dawn Wednesday raid.
There was a narrative of saying they barricaded themselves inside the mosque. They weren't barricading, because if they were barricading, we'd say, let it die a natural death. They were preparing to storm tourists, people coming to worship on the mountain. There's a status quo during Passover, which is very sensitive in timeline, where there's a four-hour window where people who are not Muslim can come and be on the mountain. The rioters that were inside the mosque were preparing to storm these worshippers. The police went in at night to prevent this from happening in daytime. And again, I'm aware that the visual coming out from one side was harsh.
It was very, very harsh. I mean, the attacks on the worshippers really were very brutal from those images.
Yes, but also if you saw our police head cameras, there was another perspective of that. I don't want to talk to the police, and I'm aware how much these pictures were problematic, and maybe we can leave it at that.
Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht. In our earlier podcast, we heard about the planned resumption of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now there are reports of what could be equally momentous. This time, the end to an 8-year bloody civil war between the Saudi-backed government in Yemen and Houthi rebels supported indirectly by Iran. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, explained that a possible breakthrough in Yemen is connected to the strengthening of relations between the Iranians and the Saudis.
The moment that it began to be clear that Iran and Saudi Arabia were trying to bury the overt hostility that's played out across the region for the past 7 or 8 years, speculation was about what effect will it have on Yemen. Because, I mean, Yemen's reached a stage of sort of stalemate in many ways. The war, the UAE, which was as involved as Saudi Arabia at one point, has pretty much pulled out. The Saudis clearly want a way out. The Houthis, they're there, they're not going anywhere, but they may be open for a deal. So I think this was a door that was already kind of open, and this is a way in. Iran and Saudi Arabia, I mean, this was a proxy battlefield for them, amongst others, in the region. The Saudis obviously much more deeply involved. Iran, in a sense, had a very good deal there. The Houthis could essentially battle themselves, but with extra support from Iran. So Iran got a lot of bang for its buck from this. But both sides now seem to be moving on, trying to look for a recalibration of relations across the region.
Can you remind us of the origins of this civil war and paint a picture of how awful it's been?
Well, I mean, to get into the origins could go a bit far back. I mean, Yemen has been in a state of flux and chaos for a long time after the Arab uprisings in 2011. The long-term president was finally forced out. And the Houthis essentially took advantage of that at a certain point. They kept on pushing and pushing, and suddenly the government was driven out, went to Saudi Arabia, took refuge there. The Saudis then, 8 years ago, intervened militarily. I think they were expecting, under Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, de facto all of it, a quick push would do it. Obviously, that hasn't been the case. And the result has been what the UN has described as, you know, the most devastating catastrophe, essentially, in recent history. 80% of the population is needing aid. Tens of thousands of people have died directly or indirectly from the war. As I say, it's a war that just hasn't been going anywhere. I mean, no one is likely to win it. Even if there is a deal, though, that's agreed, I mean, the problem is that the issues that existed before it erupted into this bigger conflict will still be there. So Yemen isn't suddenly going to return to some state where there wasn't chaos before. It was chaos and it got worse.
Sebastian Usher. Russian state media say investigators have formally charged the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich of spying for the United States. The TASS news agency said that he had categorically denied the accusations, Sarah Rainsford reports.
It's more than a week since the journalist Evan Gershkovich was arrested in Ekaterinburg, a move which his newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, has condemned and that the State Department has demanded be overturned. Mr. Gershkovich was detained whilst on a reporting trip in Russia and accused of spying. He's now been formally charged, although no evidence at all has been presented, and his friends and colleagues are sure he's been targeted for his journalism. Russia has crushed all independent local media in recent years, and when Vladimir Putin ordered the full-on invasion of Ukraine, he introduced tight censorship, making reporting from Russia far tougher, even for foreign correspondents there.
Sarah Rainsford. The issue of transgender rights is back in focus in the United States after Nike agreed a promotional partnership with the American trans influencer and TikTok star Dylan Mulvaney. Here's a clip from one of the sponsored posts on Instagram, which shows Dylan doing aerobics in a sports bra and leggings.
What's some other workout stuff?
High knees.
Our reporter Naomi Choi Smith told us more about Dylan Mulvaney and her latest partnership.
Dylan Mulvaney is a huge social media star. We're talking 11 million followers on TikTok. And she actually got her start on social media after the pandemic. She found herself unemployed. She was in some musicals and she found she didn't have a job, and she turned to social media and she became immensely popular. And since then, she's garnered the interest of all kinds of brands, from Kate Spade to Crest. And now most recently, she's drawn the attention of Nike, and she's been modeling their sports bras and their leggings in their most recent sponsorship, which has, of course, created this online uproar and controversy that we're talking about today.
Now, the Nike deal has come at a very tense time. The sporting world is still trying to navigate the transgender issue, especially for athletes.
That's right. And the World Athletics Body announced, in fact, just last month, that transgender women who have been through male puberty can no longer compete in women's events. And this is still a big issue. You know, as you mentioned, several sports bodies have moved in that general direction, but it's still a very controversial and contentious issue. And Nike has perhaps unwittingly, or some on the more cynical side, say they knowingly walked into this debate. Some are claiming that any publicity is good publicity, but with the vitriol that's been expressed online and some of these hateful comments, Nike is trying to distance itself from the backlash. They've said recently, you know, keep your comments, please, constructive. They want to embrace diversity and inclusion. So they're trying to distance themselves from that controversy and that topic.
But there certainly has been an online backlash to this. What has Dylan Mulvaney said, or the trans community, in response to that negative backlash?
Well, Dylan hasn't actually made any public comments in direct response to this controversy, but the trans community has largely rushed to defend her, saying this is about inclusion and representation and self-identifying. But on the other side, you know, you do have people in the transgender community like Caitlyn Jenner, the former track star, who you may know from Keeping Up with the Kardashians, who has actually come out to say that she doesn't believe this is the right kind of person to put in an advert for women's clothes. So you do have very diverse opinions, even within the trans community. That being said, there's been a lot of support online for Dylan from the trans community and elsewhere as she faces this backlash and some very hateful and vitriolic comments online.
Naomi Joy Smith.
Still to come.
Security calling in saying 45 minutes ago, two Delta pilots had people claiming to be FBI agents barge into their room and handcuff them to the bathroom.
Red faces at the FBI as its agents get the wrong hotel room and the wrong man. And a word about this weekend's Happy Pod from Andrew Peach.
Yes, you'll have heard on the Global News podcast about the BBC's new education programme aimed at girls and boys who can't go to school in Afghanistan. We're going to bring you some of the reaction we've had from families there in the first few days. We love hearing the sounds that make listeners happy. Alex has been in touch from New Zealand to share a recording of him meeting his birth father for the first time. We've got the first new cheetah cubs in India for 70 years, Salma in Finland, who's a taekwondo black belt at the age of 82, and who let the dogs in to a museum in Greece. All in the Happy Pod, an extra edition of the Global News podcast in this feed from Saturday.
Welcome back. Poland says Ukraine has proposed to limit or even suspend its large-scale grain exports to Poland after it emerged that those exports pushed down prices for Polish farmers. Poland's agriculture minister, Robert Telus, was speaking after a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
Mr. Telus said the temporary suspension of exports would not apply to grain transiting Poland to other markets. When Russia blockaded Ukraine's Black Sea ports, some feared the grain shortage could cause famine in traditional export markets in Africa. The EU was keen to use Poland as a new transit route, but the lack of storage and loading infrastructure required to handle the grain influx led to millions of tons remaining in the country. With a general election looming, the government, which draws much support from the countryside, was keen to resolve the issue quickly.
Adam Easton. Well, over the past few weeks, we've heard much speculation about when Ukraine might launch a counteroffensive to try to retake land seized by Russian forces. So there was much interest when the New York Times reported on Thursday that Western plans to aid the Ukrainian military had been leaked and published on social media. The paper said the Pentagon was investigating who might have leaked the documents, some of which appear to have been modified. On Friday, though, both the Ukrainians and the Russians suggested the leak of the plans might be part of a disinformation effort by the other side. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bashega, told us what is known about the documents.
There's so many questions in the story. Nothing has been officially confirmed, at least publicly. So we're talking about documents that appear to be documents with US and NATO plans to help the Ukrainian military in this much anticipated counteroffensive. Now, these documents first appeared as photographs and they were posted on social media and they're still there. And these pictures include charts with dates of when weapons are expected to be delivered to the Ukrainians. Also, the sizes of Ukrainian military units. I've got to say, we haven't been able to verify the pictures or the authenticity of these documents. But there is another intriguing element here, because in one of those pictures, some details appear to have been modified. They overstate estimates of Ukrainian military losses in the war, and they understate the number of Russian troops killed. So there's a lot of mystery involving these alleged documents and this alleged leak of information.
And the Russians say it's Ukrainian disinformation and the Ukrainians say it's Russian disinformation.
Yeah, I think we're used to claims and counterclaims in this war. So no surprise that the Russians are saying something and the Ukrainians are saying something different. So here in Kyiv, an advisor to President Zelensky told me that this apparent leak was part of a disinformation effort by Moscow. And he obviously pointed out that some of the information that had apparently been modified. And in Russia, you know, the similar claims post on a channel, on a Telegram channel used by military bloggers, said that this could have been part of a Western plot to mislead Russian commanders. So they're perhaps a little bit skeptical as well. But what is interesting is that there was another person, a spokesperson for the Ukrainian military intelligence, said that it was possible that the information in these posts on social media was entirely fake, and that there had been no leak. So the mystery continues.
Hugo Bashega. Our next story is about a Russian activist, film director, and one of the members of the controversial protest band Pussy Riot. Anna Kuzminik is on the Russian federal wanted list. She faced criminal investigations from the Russian authorities after burning Vladimir Putin's effigy. The BBC's Anastasia Zlatopolskaya talked to Anna a year after her provocative performance.
That was a performance in Georgia, in Tbilisi, during Maslenitsa. We performed a shamanic ceremony, burning the effigy of Vladimir Putin with ritual dancing.
Anna is remembering the anti-war performance that put her on the federal wanted list in Russia. I met with her in the north of Israel, where she is currently living in exile with her parents.
A criminal case was opened against me for arson. Officially, that's the offense of insulting the state symbols of the Russian Federation.
Anna tries to hold her tears when I ask her if she thinks she might never be able to go back home. Here in exile, she feels relatively safe, but she can't stop thinking of those who couldn't leave Russia, friends and activists who continue to speak out against the war in Ukraine.
People who talk about what we should have done are living in the countries where it's hard to even imagine what it means to open your mouth in Russia, and the kind of courage you need to do it, and how ultimately pointless it is. I feel huge pain for people who were for years making so much effort to build a new society. Now they are hostages of this situation. They are in Russia. The whole world hates them. They have no rights. They can be beaten or raped.
Anna shows me her drawings and the diary she kept while incarcerated in a Moscow detention center in the summer of 2021.
I asked them to let me use the toilet. The guard told me, go on your knees and beg us, then we'll let you.
She was detained along with other Pussy Riot members. They were charged with disobeying the police, hooliganism and violating COVID rules.
That was a very clear message. If you are going to stay, you are going to be in prison. We were detained all together at the same time. We were jailed for 15 days. After we were freed, we were detained again, later the same day. They have demonstrated to us that it would continue this way.
Forced to leave the country, she relocated to Georgia. However, a year later, Anna had to move again, this time to be with her parents in Israel. Under Israel's law of return, Anna's parents were eligible for Israeli citizenship as the grandchildren of Jews, but she is not.
I can't stay here legally. I have got huge issues with my health. My passport is expiring soon, and because I am under criminal investigation in Russia, I won't even be able to extend it.
Her lawyers are trying to get her a humanitarian residence permit, but it is rarely granted in Israel.
I don't have any idea what I'm going to do. So far, I'm only making plans for the next 4 hours of my life.
Most of Pussy Riot's members have escaped from Russia and continue to express the anti-war message now outside of the country.
Anna Kuzminik, a member of the protest band Pussy Riot. Thousands of people died in Northern Ireland between 1969 and 1998 in the Civil War, which was euphemistically referred to as the Troubles. Then the warring communities were finally brought together to thrash out a power-sharing deal and establish a regional political assembly at Stormont in Belfast. That accord was signed 25 years ago and is known to this day as the Good Friday Agreement. On this Good Friday, some of the key actors in that deal came together in Belfast to mark their achievement from a quarter of a century ago, including the former Taoiseach or Prime Minister of Ireland, Bertie Ahern.
Ladies and gentlemen, 25 years ago, I think we did something special. I agree with everyone who said it's not perfect, but it was substantial. Let's hope it continues to be that way and even more substantial in the future. Thank you.
The man who chaired the 1998 negotiation, US Senator George Mitchell, said the current crop of political leaders needed to act with the same courage and vision as those who secured the Good Friday Agreement.
I believe the greatest heroes were the people of Northern Ireland and their political leaders. The people supported, worked for, and established a democratic, peaceful process as their preferred form of governance. They rejected violence as a way to resolve their differences.
The anniversary of the deal comes as Northern Ireland's power-sharing institutions remain collapsed because of a protest by the largest pro-UK party, the DUP, over post-Brexit trading arrangements. I spoke to our Ireland correspondent, Emma Vardy, and asked her to put in context the importance of this agreement for peace in Britain and Ireland.
I've spent the last few weeks watching back at TV archives of 25 years ago, and it's amazing to see how much Northern Ireland has changed. Amazing to look back at some of the terrible things that happened 25 years ago and to follow that story of how that agreement was brought about. Because don't forget, the Good Friday Agreement very nearly didn't happen. Not everybody supported it then, not everybody did today.
People have estimated that as many as 2,000 people might be walking around Northern Ireland today that might not otherwise have been but for that agreement. The DUP were not part of the negotiations 25 years ago, and yet they are the key players and the kingmakers now in 2023.
That's right. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? They were the ones who were sort of shouting at the gates while others were inside at the time making this peace deal, and they're the ones who are boycotting Stormont now. But look, the DUP will argue very strongly, you know, they had their opposition to the Good Friday Agreement at the time, largely because of, you know, distrust over paramilitaries and decommissioning. Would they get rid of their weapons? Now, of course, it's all about Brexit. The DUP feel that Northern Ireland was cut off from the rest of the UK by the Brexit agreement, by the subsequent arrangements for Northern Ireland. They feel it's really undermined Northern Ireland's status as part of the UK and their unionist ideology. And that's why they're not in Stormont today. But there are some parallels with the past, aren't there? So lots of questions about whether the Good Friday Agreement and the power-sharing government that it set up back then is fit for purpose today, when we see it does often, pretty recently, it does often collapse.
Yes, it does collapse, and it does beg the question whether the Good Friday Agreement and the protocols within it should be amended to allow traditional forms of government, which currently aren't allowed, because one side of the sectarian divide can always have a veto over the other, and you cannot form a government, according to the Good Friday Agreement, without the blessing of both sides.
Yeah, exactly. It's that veto, isn't it? One or other can pull out, and they both have done. You know, one of the biggest changes there's been in recent years is that more and more people are not voting for unionist or nationalist parties, but they're voting for the centre ground parties. But not quite enough yet. It's still Sinn Féin and the DUP who are the two largest parties. But demographics are certainly changing, and that's why those calls to perhaps reform the system of government here are getting louder. But it's really difficult. It's not something that can be done really easily. Of course, that was embedded in the Good Friday Agreement, this idea of equality and consent between unionists and nationalists.
Emma Vardy. The FBI has apologised for a mix-up during a training exercise that led to agents bursting into a hotel room in Boston and detaining a guest. They handcuffed an airline pilot in his bathroom, believing he was role-playing as part of the drill. Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue takes up the story.
Picture this. You've had a long day, you're away from home, and you decide to get an early night in your hotel room. You're asleep on the 15th floor, and all of a sudden, boom, there's a bunch of people calling themselves FBI agents at your door, forcing their way in, and, wait a minute, they're taking you into the bathroom and handcuffing you in the shower. They then proceed to interrogate you for around 45 minutes before you persuade them that you're just a regular Delta Airlines pilot, and not the kingpin of an international terrorist organisation. Such was the scene on Tuesday night in Boston, when the hapless FBI agents got the wrong room during their training exercise, no doubt amazed at how well the man in the shower was playing his part, resisting all their techniques and questioning. The voice over the police radio showed that officers who were called to the scene clearly shared the pilot's bemusement.
Security calling in saying 45 minutes ago, two Delta pilots had people claiming to be FBI agents barge into their room and handcuff them to the bathroom.
At around 12:30, the police were persuaded that this was indeed a training exercise, and happily the pilot did not need medical attention. The FBI says it takes the incident very seriously and is conducting an investigation. So far, the pilot has said nothing publicly, no doubt busy enough with the kind of turbulence he's actually used to.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington, D.C. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I am Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.